The Tom Woods Show, episode 2328.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, believing that the end of the world might be a bad thing that we should try to avoid is not a Russian talking point. But if we are going to avoid World War III, it's important for Americans to understand what's been left out of the CIA's narrative about Russia and Ukraine. Coming to the rescue here is my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Ukraine. Pick it up at wrongaboutukraine.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm really delighted to welcome Ashley Rinsberg to the show. He is an investigative journalist. He's got a very interesting project, actually, that he's working on now. I want to get to a little bit later, but I want to talk specifically today about a book of his that was recommended to me by friend of the show, Gene Epstein. Last time I had lunch with him in Manhattan, he said, "You gotta get Ashley Rinsberg on. I just heard him do an interview about his book, The Gray Lady Winked, How the New York Times Misreporting, Distortions, and Fabrications Radically Alter History." So Ashley, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you. And I had no idea that this came about through our mutual friend, Gene.
Oh yeah. Gene makes very good recommendations. And so because of Gene's reputation for being a good recommendation maker, I just sight unseen went to go get you booked. I wrote immediately to my assistant,
amazing.
"We have to go get this guy." And then only after the fact did I read the book, but I knew Gene knows what he's talking about. So at the very beginning of your book, you say that when this project began to form in your mind, you were a naive mid-20s guy who felt like this is the kind of public service that a young, idealistic, ambitious writer ought to do. Because who doesn't want the record to be corrected? Who doesn't want to be told the truth? And so we should hold major institutions accountable, like the New York Times, when they fail to do so. But according to what you say early on in the book, that was not exactly the response you got from many of the people you ran this project by. So what in fact did happen?
Yeah, well, as you said, I wrote this book when I was in sort of mid-20s, early 20s. I was living in Tel Aviv, and I just found these stories that I unearthed so compelling and so vital to understanding this institution of the New York Times that I, like so many other people, had just always understood to be the gold standard of credibility. And as I dug up these stories, I started to understand that that was actually very much not the case. And when I took the book out to agents and editors, publishers, et cetera, I was able to use some of my network to get to the right people, very, very well-placed people, the top executives at agencies, literary agencies and publishers in New York, things like that. And some of them just told me straight up that they could not risk angering the New York Times with a book like this, that it would jeopardize their business, that it would jeopardize their other clients. And I actually, at the time, I was dismayed. I can now sort of appreciate that from a business point of view, because the New York Times is incredibly powerful. They are, maybe vindictive is the wrong word, but they pay attention to the people who are criticizing them. And their New York Times bestseller list is far and away the most powerful tool in all of book marketing. And nobody wants to risk having clients blackballed. And they do blackball writers. That's an editorial property for them, meaning it's not strictly by the numbers. It's what they decide goes in and does not go in. So it was kind of a non-starter. I got to that point where I'd written this book and I knew it was good, or at least I thought it was good. I think when you're younger and kind of first time around and you're not really sure, like maybe these experts so-called are, maybe they're right. And maybe this is just not the right thing, so to speak. But in any case, I said, okay, and, you know, I sort of took my licking and put the book in a drawer and left it there for 15 years or so until 2021.
Wow. And then you, of course, self-published it.
I did. And I kind of at that point really came to believe in the idea of self-publishing, or the way I thought about it was acting as your own publisher, which means not that you type something on Word and then like slap it on Amazon, but it means hiring editors and hiring fact checkers and hiring designers and layout people and marketing people and public relations people. I probably had a team of about a dozen people or so working for this book at some point or another. So I served as my own publisher in that regard, even though I actually had an offer from one of the people who had rejected the book way back when, 15 years ago or something, a very, very well-known editor, sort of a luminary who wanted this book, wanted to buy it in 2020. And I got to this point where the question was between going with prestige and going with legacy and giving up all your rights and giving up, this person wanted the title changed and he wanted this and that done. And he probably would have been right about these things. He's a very astute person. But I got to the point where I had said to myself, this is about independence. This is about freedom. This is about ownership and authorship and doing what I believe is the right thing for the book and the journey that this book has been on. I gave it the name that it has, The Gray Lady Winked, all those years ago. And this editor who I spoke with actually had a very good title in mind. And I was very tempted to take it, but that wasn't me. That wasn't my title. So I did end up telling him, no, thank you. And I went and did it my own way.
And as you say in the book, self-publishing is looking more and more like the way to go in a lot of content creation, not just books, but musicians and other artists are finding that, you know what, it's actually easier to make your way in the world than you thought without a big label, a big publisher, this and that. I've written a lot of books, but I haven't written one for 9 years. And I'm thinking of writing one this year. And of the whole bunch that I've written, I only self-published one of them. But I had such a good experience with it, even though I've done really well with big publishers too, that right now I'm not even considering getting a contract with a bigger publisher. I mean, there's a chance that they might be able to get me better media than I could get on my own. Sometimes, not always. But I don't want the aggravation. I don't want their deadline. I don't want the huge chunk they take away from me. I don't want to wait a year for it to be on the shelf. You know what I mean?
Yeah. All those things are part of the calculus. Then something that authors today need to think through, the year that you're talking about waiting can often be much more than a year if they decide that. And the book can get pushed, it can get pushed around, and they can play all sorts of tricks with your contract. And there's so much that can go wrong. And at the end of the day, for them, you're competing with the next book that comes out under their imprint, because it's not about the book, it's about the current book. So there are a lot of factors. At the end of the day, for me, I do think we're kind of at this cusp of a new era of publishing, as you mentioned, all formats and all types of content. And it's new, but it's old, as many things are. I mean, we think about Ben Franklin publishing his own newspaper so many years ago. Foundational texts of the United States were published that way because the establishment was not interested in what these people had to say. And suddenly you have technologies like we have today. We have Substack and we have podcasts and we have all sorts of amazing tools to do these things. And it just makes more sense to get the word out rather than to try to appease this matrix of gatekeepers who are not as interested in the ideas as they are in keeping their colleagues and their peers at bay and not stepping on any landmines politically or whatever else might be the case.
So what do you think, before we get into specific examples that you outline in the various chapters, what do you think is really going on here? Is there a pattern in the way the New York Times gets things wrong? Like, for instance, there was a roundtable hosted by The Atlantic and maybe one other institution at the University of Chicago last year. And it was a panel on misinformation. And a student stood up and said, the problem really seems to be misinformation coming from the media outlets themselves. And what's interesting about the misinformation is that it all seems to go in one direction. It's all pro-government misinformation. You know, it's all misinformation that happens to amplify the regime's narrative over and over and over. You're telling me that's just a coincidence? So likewise with the New York Times, is it that the reporters have an ideological bias? Is it that they like being cozy with the powerful, and so therefore they maybe even subconsciously want to please them? What do you think is going on?
I think it's both of those things. I think that there is a bias, a political bias that aligns with the establishment. They share that bias. And I also think that over the last few years, there's been kind of this coagulation of big media, big government, and also big brands, big companies, that they have become almost, the lines have blurred in a very disturbing way. And we really saw that with the Twitter files, where You've got this crazy mix of big tech, Twitter in this case, and I'm sure it happened in Facebook and others. We just don't know it. The FBI or whoever it might have been in getting involved, sometimes it was the White House, and the media, the New York Times and co, who are publishing the stuff that the government establishment wants published, and the government establishment is then reaching out to the big tech to tell them what not to publish. And then big tech is boosting the right stuff and censoring so-called wrong stuff. And it's all working synergistically. It's like a super corporation where power and money and ideology have become this stew, this toxic stew in America. I'm sure it's always been there to an extent, but I really do feel it's shifted because at least nominally, at least on the face of things, you used to have the media somewhat at odds with government. They didn't like that government would launch wars. And after the New York Times and co were sort of cheerleading the Iraq war for a few months, they swung back in the other direction and they were quite critical and they really were against that war for the rest of it. And now we're seeing a very different picture with the Ukraine war where the cheerleading has not stopped. They're continuing to cheerlead and continuing to push for this kind of total victory that even if it has any remote likelihood is going to be incredibly costly, not just in terms of American treasure, but in terms of lives, in terms of the lives of civilians in Ukraine. The longer this goes on, the worse it gets for them. So we've seen this kind of new power structure emerge. Eisenhower warned about a military-industrial complex. We're kind of seeing something that's more like a media-industrial complex, and media broadly construed that includes brand media, all the branding that delivers these ideas to the people on a very ground level. People are not necessarily reading the New York Times every day, but they are consuming brand media and brand culture. And that part of the media does get the same ideas from the news media. And the news media seems to be taking its cues from the government and from the establishment, which, again, it's just a very strange thing to watch. And we really saw that in very painful detail with COVID. And some of the storylines that emerged out of the media really were coming from the top echelons of government and were just accepted. They were not challenged. And just one more piece of this, we're also seeing the revolving door spinning very quickly between media and government. You know, we see Jen Psaki getting a job, I believe at MSNBC, as an anchor while she's still serving in government. I mean, that is remarkable. It was so remarkable that NBC, some of the reporters and staffers at NBC kind of were up in arms for about 30 minutes until they were told to quiet down. But it really was a remarkable moment where this woman is hired while still in government. And nobody thought that to be problematic.
Yeah, there are all kinds of issues like that. But yet, we have only so much time to get into so many of them. So I actually want to focus on maybe a couple of the lesser known items in your book. I mean, I've talked about Walter Duranty before and the shameful history regarding the famine in Ukraine. And let's just say the New York Times has a weirdly mixed, let's say, record when it comes to totalitarianism. You'd expect that would be a pretty easy test to pass, but right, not so much for them. But I want to actually talk about something I hadn't known about until I read your book, involving the chapter on the aftermath of the atomic bombings of Japan and what happened to people afterward. And I had not realized that officials in the U.S. and perhaps the official U.S. government line was that this bomb, it's true, was more powerful than other bombs, but it was just a matter of degree, not of kind. And so if a lot of people are going to die from this bomb, it's because this bomb lets out a really, really big blast. But it turned out that people kept on dying for days and days and weeks afterward, when obviously the blast was long over, so something else must be taking place. And the New York Times more or less looked the other way. Well, more than looked the other way. That would almost exonerate them.
Yeah. The chapter on that incident begins with the story about a brilliant New York Times science writer named William Lawrence, who was just, he was so sharp and so on this beat of new nuclear technology that was being developed by scientists who were far ahead of the government, that the government actually came and started telling him to slow down and really to censor him because he was putting stuff out there that was considered dangerous. And then suddenly he stops publishing about this stuff and goes back to publishing about like vitamin C and whatever, boring things. And then he resurfaces on the nuclear issue, literally from within a bomber on the way to drop a nuclear bomb. on Nagasaki. And that's how he writes the story. He actually starts the story saying, "We are on a bomber on the way to drop the bomb on Nagasaki." It was the first line of the story from that day. And the weird thing is the Times, even then, was not that shy about this, but they had made a deal. They had struck a deal with the War Department. And the deal was that the New York Times would get a seat on that bomber. They'd get access to some of the bombing test sites. They were really getting very behind the scenes glimpses into the Manhattan Project, culminating in the dropping of the nuclear bomb on Nagasaki. And in exchange, they would help with the propaganda. And there was a story about this in the New York Times. The story's title was "War Department Called Times Reporter to Explain Intricacies to the Public." And that included, I think one of the quotes was that this same reporter, William Lawrence, helped write bales, this is a quote, "bales of War Department handouts designed to enlighten laymen on the working of the atomic bomb." Part of that was to put forth this notion that there was no such thing as radiation poisoning. That is very much what Lawrence wrote. And he sometimes actually contradicted other New York Times reporters who kind of got through the New York Times censorship on the issue and put out at least one article saying there was radiation poisoning. They went to Japan and spoke to people on the ground, and it was clear that that was happening. And that was shut down. And the New York Times got that second reporter back in line. But that was really what they did. They denied that there was radiation poisoning. They couldn't get away with it for too long. It was too obvious and there was too much evidence on the ground. But it was really these crucial first moments. Again, it was just like COVID, like where the question of where the virus came from really mattered in the first few months where public opinion gets set. In this case, it was the same thing. It was what happened in the first few months. What is the narrative that people embrace in the first few months? And there was the New York Times telling the world that there's no such thing as radiation poisoning. This is just like any other bomb. It's just bigger. And that had a big effect, that people actually end up believing that. And they did it in this quid pro quo fashion in concert with the government. And this was out and out propaganda. It's not propaganda using that term metaphorically. This was literal propaganda.
But on the other hand, what I don't quite understand is presumably they have to be thinking about the long term with these bombs, not just about Japan, but presumably at that time, since the U.S. had a monopoly on their possession, that these bombs would be a deterrent. I mean, you wouldn't expect to use them on a regular basis, but they'd be a deterrent to others. So why would you want to downplay the bomb? Why wouldn't you say, yeah, not only does it have a huge blast, but it is going to cause absolute utter devastation? Was it that they thought that would hurt the U.S.'s reputation too much, so it wasn't worth it? I mean, I would think if you were a really evil bastard, you'd want to boast about the destructive power of your bomb.
My guess is that as the government, you have a new technology. It's very scary. It's a new weapon. And people get nervous about that, especially when part of its destructive capability is through something that you can't see or touch or smell, something that could be everywhere and nowhere, and that could be just, that could blow with the winds. And from Japan to Hawaii to the West Coast, people didn't understand that and probably wouldn't understand it today, where you think, what stops this whatever invisible force causing radiation poisoning, radiation sickness, from blowing over to America if that's what it does and killing all the rest of us? If it's not the blast that kills, then what does kill and what stopped that killer from ending up killing me and my family? And that probably would have been a pretty good concern to harbor. Who knows, right? Because these are things that are more or less classified. I'm not sure exactly what the concern was. But it's something like that, where you don't want to scare the public at a time where you've just unveiled this terrifying new weapon, and there already is so much controversy around it that you want to try to keep it as familiar as you possibly can. That would be my guess.
Let's talk a bit about Fidel Castro now, because in the late 50s, the usual story is that Castro was or intended to be non or even anti-communist, but he was just forced into an alliance with communists and to become a communist because of the unfriendly reception he got from the U.S. government. So the New York Times seemed to posit quite confidently, that Castro was not a communist well before they could really have known, given that there was very little to go on.
Yeah, that was how they unveiled him when he was sort of fading away in the mountains of Cuba as this rebel. He had a cause, but he didn't have much else. He didn't have many men. He didn't have much weaponry. He didn't have money. And then the New York Times, via one of their correspondents named Herbert Matthews, goes and finds him and writes this huge story and speaks about him in messianic terms, and then goes on to just manufacture these stories about Castro as a democratic savior, as this figure that all of Cuba had implicitly voted for him, even after he had taken control, when they never had a chance to actually vote because he instituted dictatorship. But it didn't matter for the New York Times. This was really about pure democracy, a pure democratic figure, so pure that you didn't even have to vote for him. So whether or not he was communist or had communist sympathies or socialist sympathies, the New York Times had no way of knowing that in 1957 when they first had their coming out party for Fidel Castro. And in terms of the United States reception to him, the United States government didn't really have a good opportunity to meet Castro through proper diplomatic channels, in part because the New York Times and a few other newspapers and magazines in New York decided that it would be a very good idea to have him come speak at an annual conference of magazine editors, and invited and took it upon themselves without consulting the State Department to bring him over. And that was his first trip to the US, and it was not done through the State Department, and that became a bit of a stumbling block. So there were a lot of different factors at work here, but I would say the biggest of them was the most important newspaper in the world proclaiming him to be a democratic messiah who is there to save the people and liberate the people of Cuba, and never really exploring any counter ideas to that notion. That was really just the line that they pursued.
I've had a guy named Umberto Fontova on a number of times whose family is Cuban, and they have very strong feelings about Castro. And one of the points that he makes is also something I read in your book, which is not to downplay the Batista dictatorship, but to say that for Castro years later to point to the literacy rates and this figure and that figure is a bit disingenuous, because all you have to do is look at what were those figures like before he got in power. And actually, when compared with other comparable countries, Cuba was actually doing fairly well before Castro.
Yeah, I think that became something of a talking point. I'm not really sure where it came from, but Batista was a dictatorship, and so was Castro, and so is Castro's Cuba. Still is, of course. And yeah, Batista's dictatorship, the country was not terribly run. I mean, there was economic growth and there was a certain amount of progress. I think there were some statistics there that Cubans had, I think, 1 in 5 owned a radio, which that was second only to Argentina in terms of Latin American economic progress at the time. And 1 in 39 Cubans owned a car at the time, which was 1 in 60 owned one in Argentina and 1 in 90 in Mexico and 1 in 160 in Brazil. So it wasn't doing terribly poorly. It was a dictatorship. Things were not perfect and they were not democratic. But again, neither were they under Castro. I mean, if anything, they got worse, where you have mass imprisonment of political prisoners and gays and whatever else is still going on there. So I do think that was a bit of a deflection, that argument.
Hey, friends, a quick message from our sponsor, Blinkist. I can tell you personally that the kind of people I admire most, the kind of people I most want to be like, are people who have interesting and informed opinions on pretty much everything, such that I'm always curious to know what they think about X, Y, or Z. Imagine how nice it would be to be such a person. And well, it's easier than you think, thanks to Blinkist, an amazing app that gives you the key takeaway points of thousands and thousands of nonfiction titles in just 15-minute written and spoken chunks. Now, there are plenty of books you do not want to read the old-fashioned way. You'll spend 5 hours reading them, and the only things you're going to remember are the key takeaways that Blinkist would have given you anyway. This is especially true with self-help books. Oh my gosh, are these books full of fluff or what? But yet, they very often do have some critical insights. Well, all I want is the insights. I don't want to waste 10 hours going through fluff. And so the books in the Blinkist 14-day personal growth challenge are a great way for me to absorb a lot of valuable stuff in a really short amount of time. They have an amazing new feature, Blinkist Connect, which is in effect 2 subscriptions for the price of 1. You can share titles with your best friend. You arm yourself with the knowledge you can get very, very easily through Blinkist, and you will become that person people look up to and are dying to hear from, the kind of person who makes a great first impression. Well, right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. And now for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You'll get 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1. Let's fast forward a bit. Most people, I think, except the really youngest listeners, will remember the Jason Blair matter. This was somebody who fabricated stories, and he was preceded at the New Republic by a guy, Stephen Glass, who did the same thing.
Right.
He wrote a whole bunch of fabricated stories. They made a movie about that, but did you ever see that movie? It was called Shattered Glass.
No, I never did. I do remember it coming out.
It's worth watching, actually, because it's showing how his fabrications began to unravel.
Right.
It really is like it's like a thriller in a way, but you know that it's real. So one thing I did not realize about Jason Blair till I read in your book was that anybody should have figured out that something was up. Not so much even from the content of the pieces, but the sheer volume and diversity of topics and geographical areas he would have to have been in, especially for a novice journalist, even a seasoned veteran, would have had a hard time accomplishing this.
Yeah. It was not a hard time. It was literally physically impossible to do what he claimed to have done in terms of racing around the country and showing up to interview sources. He wasn't saying he was on the phone with these people. He's saying he was in person doing interviews in locations that were just, you would have to actually teleport. There's just no way to get it done. And also, yes, what you kind of allude to in terms of his output was just impossible. I mean, there's just no way anyone could do that. It's just crazy where you're filing multiple stories a week on 3 or 4 different subject matters. He's covering the DC snipers. He's covering soldiers returning home from war. And it's just beyond belief. And he's filing expense reports. Just had no, like, he was barely filing any expenses. And this is obviously not what a journalist would do. They don't earn that much money. So, you know, I think I have here where he was writing articles that appeared on March at that time. This was early 2000s, March 25th, 27th, 31, and then April 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 11th, 13th, 15th, 19th, all the while supposedly traveling around the country to do these interviews. It's not possible. So this is something the New York Times, had anyone been paying attention, and in fact, some people actually were. There were editors there who were reporting him upward to the masthead or to senior editors. But if anyone were properly paying attention, he would have been caught right away and would have been fired. And he was actually not caught by the New York Times. He was caught by a reporter at a different publication.
Yeah, that's right. That is interesting. It wasn't any kind of internal audit or something that turned this up. And I'm glad you mentioned the thing about the receipts, because I was wondering, since everybody wants to get reimbursed for expenses, was he fabricating the receipts? But no, he just wasn't presenting any receipts. People are bound to ask eventually. You do want to be paid for that flight to Maryland or something, I assume.
Yeah. Especially you're a junior reporter and you're traveling, incurring all these expenses, and you're living in New York City, which is not particularly cheap even then. And yeah, you would have to be paid. So he was just not filing expense reports. Just one of many, many red flags related to Jason Blair. But what kept it going was, number one, he was considered this up and coming star. He was a young Black reporter and came from this sort of an internship to the New York Times, partly for diversity, but more than that, he was bringing the goods. And the goods at that time were these reports about soldiers coming back from Iraq, disaffected, jaded, disillusioned, broken. And that fit the narrative. The narrative was that this war that the New York Times had actually supported and had done more than any other news outlet to corroborate the Bush administration claims, they were now swinging back the other way and saying this war is a debacle, which of course it actually was, but not for the reasons the New York Times was saying, which is that the soldiers were coming back saying the soldiers in many of these cases, when the Times went back to actually interview these people, they didn't say any of those things. They didn't say, I feel broken. They say, I lost a leg or an arm, but I feel proud of my service, which is a very different kind of message to send.
What can you tell us about Judith Miller and WMDs?
So yeah, that was sort of the first part of the Blair story. So where Blair is coming out talking about how disastrous this war was, it was Miller who probably more than anybody else did the work that would support Bush administration claims that there were WMDs in Iraq. And she did this sort of drumbeat of stories that culminated in a big story where she supposedly was with a source who was pointing to the ground where components of WMDs had been buried by Saddam Hussein. And she never corroborated that independently. She didn't even interview that source. She just saw him from a distance. And this is the kind of thing that, this is a huge story. It should have been, I would think, more properly vetted. There should have been a higher standard. But the New York Times at that moment was trying to raise what its editor, Howell Raines, called its competitive metabolism. They wanted to be number one on the national stage. They didn't want to be this very prestigious regional, maybe somewhat national newspaper known for its New York coverage. They wanted to be America's newspaper. They wanted to be number one. They were losing Pulitzer Prizes. They were losing scoops to the Washington Post, their biggest competitor, and they wanted to put an end to that. And when Howell Raines was brought on as a new editor, he was saying, we're going to go after red-blooded stories, even if that meant siding with the Bush administration, as repugnant as that would be to the left-leaning Times. But they went too far with that, as often they do. And that's one of the through lines of the book where people, and you kind of mentioned this earlier in the talk, where sometimes they seem to have supported the fascists, as they do in the first chapter of my book. Sometimes they seem to support the communists, as they do in the second chapter with Durante. And how do you resolve the contradiction? And the answer for me is, it's always just about being number one. It's always about the New York Times and the family controlling it, but it's always about the Times getting that Pulitzer, getting that scoop, and doing it at all costs. So that's really what the Times is about. And it works. When you take that tack and you're willing to sacrifice anything, you will achieve that specific goal. The New York Times has more Pulitzer Prizes than any other news organization in America. It's almost double the Washington Post, which is the next closest competitor. So that's what was going on with WMDs in Iraq. This is the biggest story at that time of the early 21st century. And they wanted to be the newspaper that broke that story. And they did.
Can you fill us in on, I kind of teased a little bit at the beginning, your current project involving media bias. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah. So this book, sort of after everything I had experienced trying to publish it, it a bit unexpectedly struck a chord, including with the tech community and crypto community, Bitcoin. And as I sort of dug into that more, I'd worked in and around tech previously in my career, so I had a little bit of background context. But as I dug into this and why it was such an important book for those two communities, I started to understand that there's a bigger dynamic at play with people in tech looking at the media and feeling like these are people with what I now call the power of credibility that they hold in their hands and they don't wield it always wisely. So the thinking was, I can do this with a single book and a single newspaper and 10 instances of history, as I did in The Gray Lady Winked. But to really have an impact that can scale, it's got to be technology. So I launched a startup, which is called Aletheia. That comes from the Greek word for truth, aletheia. And in Greek, truth is, that word is a verb, meaning it's a process. It's not a noun like veritas in Latin or truth in English, which is a noun that you possess. I have it, or you have it, one of us has it. And if I have it, I can use it to bludgeon my opponent over the head. And that's what we're seeing in America today. But if it's a process, if it's something that we do, then we have something that's a much more collaborative approach to truth. And that's what this is about. It's about using technology to measure media error and measure media bias, and for people to do their best to approximate those two things, in part by trading information, data, statistics, and charts and graphs, rather than trading barbs and insults, as we really now have on Twitter. So we're building that out. We're building the tech. It's obviously going to involve AI. AI is very effective in being able to do these types of tasks specifically. And that is what I'm building. It's called Aletheia. It's aletheia.com, Aletheum. If you go to that website, there's a sign up for the email. People can get on the beta waiting list to be able to test some of the features as they come out. And there's a Telegram group. If anyone wants to join that Telegram group, that's also on the website. They're answering questions and talking to people. So yeah, that's what we're up to.
Well, excellent. I'll link to that site and also to your book, The Gray Lady Winked, which I highly recommend, at tomwoods.com/2328. Ashley, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.